Would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Jeremy Messersmith.
I did my research. You haven't done a million interviews over the years, so this is kind of cool. There isn't as much tactile evidence into your existence and reality as one would like. But I do know that it's been 10 years. It's been 4 albums. You could probably put it in, 2006 zone or something like that. But what I want to do is get some things that are going to inform people, like get them into your music, man. Huh. So what I'd like is some revisionist history. And by the way, if you want to lie as you talk about this, some really creative lying would be great. But here's what I know. Okay. I know Minneapolis. I know it's really cold there. I know that we're going to talk about a Mr. Wilson somewhere in this at some point, because there was some influence involved in that. And that's kind of, Dan is kind of the coolest guy in existence, so that's pretty cool. So fill in some blanks. What are some things that people, we're going to get into all the stuff about the record, but what are some things that when you get asked the obvious things, people kind of leave out?
Oh, well, I'll just kind of tell a little bit of my backstory, I guess.
Yeah,
but
okay.
I grew up in rural Washington State, and I ended up going to college in Minneapolis at a place called North Central University, which...
What did you go to college? I'm going to do it in the full announcer voice. Tell me, Jeremy, what did you go to college at North Central University for?
Well, I went to school for music, although... But before that, I actually picked up an associate's in computer science, which most people don't know, from just my local community college. My parents were insistent that before I ran off and did anything artsy, that
you had to have a real career.
I should know how to do something in case it flopped. So I did that, and I worked tech support through college. But I ended up in Minneapolis kind of on a whim. It turned out the pastor of my local church went to school with somebody who was a vice president at North Central, and we talked on the phone for like 5 minutes, and I thought, yeah, okay, sure, I'll go there. It seemed fine. Once I went there, I found out that its most notable alumni were Jim and Tammy Faye Baker from PTL.
That explains a lot about your music, by the way.
Oh, thanks, and I'm sorry.
Deeper themes than we will get to, however.
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot in there.
There's something there.
So I went out there for school and started playing music around the Twin Cities. I was kind of too nervous to book my own gigs, and so my girlfriend, now wife, booked a show for me at a coffee shop, first time.
Old guitar bought at a pawn shop.
It was something like that. It certainly wasn't a nice guitar. Actually, I take it back. It wasn't even my guitar. I didn't even have one, but she had like a very low-end Martin that I borrowed.
It had to be.
That I borrowed for all of my early gigs.
This is super important,
Yes.
Right? This when they do the biography, when they do the 90-minute doc, you've got to have that original guitar, and you've got to have the pan in on the strings, and it's out of tune and all of that.
Yeah, exactly that. But she booked me my first gig, and then I was like, I gotta have some songs to play at it. So I did, a bunch of cover songs, but then I tried writing some of my own.
And do you remember, I'm gonna do the obvious NME question. Do you remember the first cover?
I don't remember the first, but I remember I covered, I think I ended up doing Paranoid Android by Radiohead at some point. One of my college roommates knew could play the, Johnny Greenwood electric.
That's not your average not your average hotel cafe guy with a guitar cover song, You really, if like you're blowing your cover there in a big way. You're going deep now.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that was the main one I remember covering. I think I might have done like some Ben Harper or something like that as well. But
okay, well, good. You got us back to
back
to some reality. Okay, so we're just gonna launch right in.
Yeah.
You've gone from the Dead to Heart Murmurs. Now think about it. You've done this in reverse order here because you really should have the Heart Murmurs before you covered the Dead.
Yeah, you'd think so, but
yeah.
Well, it was a little like, I did a record on death, and I was like, "Well, where do I go from here?"
yeah, exactly. Like, once you've done death, there's no going back.
No, not really. So, I guess I did it in more of a a lot of the reviews I got were like, "Yeah, some of this music's pretty cool. I don't know why he's writing about all this weird stuff." Like death, and my previous record was like transportation, and like I don't know, it was kind of funny. So I was like, "No, I'm gonna do like a." like a real serious record with a classic theme. So I started working on writing love songs.
But I love this quote, and I'm gonna throw a few of these at you. But this is really cool, because this is what really clued me in when I had heard the record. And the first thing you do when you hear the record, you know, whether it's Only Dancing or Bubble, you know, whatever it is, you go, boy, this guy. And then I read, and I love this, because I do this in life too, and we all do, but nobody admits to it, that it's not biographical, that it's processing things that are unresolved. That's a really cool way of saying that it's not directly about you, but it's about your inner thoughts and some of the things that you need to get out there so you can live your life in some sort of a normal fashion.
Yeah, it lets you process things so that, you know, you can sing all this really sad stuff, and it really lets you be happy a lot of the time when you're not actually singing. So, you know, a lot of times things start off like, you know, maybe like with a biographical thing, but then I'll usually take it someplace different, or I'll expand on the idea, because, you know, real life doesn't let you, doesn't often resolve in ways that, you know, songs and fiction.
Yeah, you kind of need a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Pretty much, yeah, and I'm still in the middle of at least of my life.
Well, one would hope. If not, thank you for your Epiphanous album. That was really nice, and it was a really good way to end. No question about it. The other thing, now it's interesting, because I saw you acoustically before South By a while back, you know, for a small thing, but then I was in church. And what a great place to be. This is a different kind of religious experience. You know, bad pun. But the thing rocked, right? And, you know, and I've been in that church for a lot of shows. And the last thing that I expected, and I'd heard the record, was it to rock so much. Are people surprised when they come and they go, wait a minute, this isn't El Singer songwriter, oh guy, Mitt Guitar. This is songwriting rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, people seem to be generally surprised and confused also, because I've toured for years with either just me or me and one other person or two other people or something. So a lot of times you'll see people just kind of in, you know, sort of shock, as just oh boy, I didn't know that you were going to be that loud. That's kind of amazing, you know.
It was great. The other thing that you've said a lot of times, And I think you're blowing this now. I have to tell you, you're blowing a part of your life, is that, you know, quote, that selling out at home was just fine, and that there's no major career goals, that you don't have the grand giant mission statement. And then what do? You sign with Glassnote Records. So what's your get to Glassnote story?
My get to Glassnote story is actually Daniel's son, Liam, who turns out was a fan a number of years ago, and told his dad about me, and it's like, hey, I think this guy's playing at South by Southwest. This was maybe 4 years ago or something, and Daniel came out to a show, met him, said it was fantastic, and he said, hey, if you ever want help with a record or anything, you know, let's keep in touch. So, you know, finished up Heart Murmurs, and they were the first and last people I ended up talking to about.
Were you the aware of the guy that was coming up to you at the time, that this was who this was?
I think my manager had mentioned, oh, this is Daniel, he runs a record label called Glassnote. I think I looked it up later, and I was like, oh, Phoenix, you know, okay, that's, they're great, love them, you know, but I didn't think too much of it at the time.
Well, you said first and last, so, well, pretty much. It was I hate to use the word organic, but I think most of their signings are that way. That either someone comes to them and says, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, which never works.
Right.
That, it never works with them. They don't have an A&R department. You met the A&R department.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Because this is conceivably bigger than the things you did before. So you obviously had some reason in mind to choose said producer and to get a certain sound, and we're not going to talk about like what the sound is, but it's more that this is a very cohesive record.
Oh, good.
In the way it sounds.
Good. I'm so glad you think so.
That'll be $5, please.
Oh, thanks. Well, it felt like the record was produced by Andy Thompson and with some production and by Ben Allen as well. Did a week with Ben Allen to kind of polish up some.
He's kind of okay.
He's pretty incredible.
He kind of knows his stuff.
I was very impressed, yeah. And I hope we get to work together in the future. But the bulk of it, I mean, like the year and a half of work that it took to do most of Heart Murmurs was working with Andy Thompson, and we've worked on my last
A year and a half. So a year and a half. So is that a week on, 6 weeks off to do some touring kind of thing?
It wasn't so much touring, but we were both working like day jobs, you know? I mean, like we were both teaching at McNally Smith College of Music. So it was, you know, we would spend like a couple mornings a week. We would, maybe spend like one or two full days working on it in his basement. And we really just worked on the songs for a long time. We both, I think, knew that we wanted it to be a bit bigger. And so we just kind of went with it, you know. We're dealing with the classic theme. Let's try to get some bigger classic sounds and see if people like it.
And I'm gonna right in the middle here. We'll just make this the little middle. That Dan Wilson guy whose favorite quote is "An artist without movement is easily forgotten."
Oh yes.
So that's a really cool quote, and perhaps that relates to this record because you did make a move. You kind of, somewhere in your head, you paid attention to what he says and said, okay. And not that this is going to be the record, but there was something that went on to move you towards this thing.
Yeah, as an artist, the goal is to always be doing something new. And part of the trap can kind of be, I've seen this happen to, I guess, more than a few bands, and not some that I know personally, but there's pressure to just make the same record again, which you can never really do because you're not the same people anymore and you're not responding to the same kind of thing. So it should always be a process of growth and trying to do something new. Try to do whatever's fresh and interesting to you. And that's what we tried to do with this record.
These are love songs. And yet you've been quoted as saying that you don't know what love is and still don't since. So it's unrequited in a big way. So these are non-love, failure, love, I'm doing well in love, but I'm not doing well in love, but no one cares songs.
Yep, that sums it up exactly right. I mean,
I relate.
It started off so easy. I was like, oh, I'll just write some love songs. They'll be sweet and that'll be it. I know what a love song is. And then I just kept kind of like digging myself deeper and deeper and deeper. And I was like, oh, I really have no idea what I'm talking about half the time. It can mean I like you to I would die for you. I mean, that's a huge range.
Or I'm going to hurt you and make you cry.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, you can love someone and still utterly destroy them. You know, I'm still trying to. It was funny, my wife was actually making fun of me the other day because I said, I love you. And then I said, you know what? And I really like you, too.
How does Dungeons & Dragons affect your songwriting?
Oh, well, it's...
Someone has told me, a little person in my ear has told me you're a little obsessed.
Yeah, well, I play with my bandmates, which is actually quite fun. I think it helps our collaborative relationship because Dungeons & Dragons is just collaborative storytelling. I mean, that's all it really is, so... As a dungeon master, I provide like a loose story framework, and then everybody just throws in. We're constantly improvising with each other, and it translates, I think, musically onto the stage.
And it also means that you get to live life as much like Mr. Spock as you possibly can, which is another thing you've said multiple times.
That's true. Well, you know,
because Dungeons and Dragons, Mr. Spock would find that it actually all lines up really well, doesn't it?
I think so. I think if you put it together, I'm a bit of a nerd. But you know, I try to live my life as rationally as possible, and you know, maybe that's entirely impossible, but you know, I do the best I can.
So what I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs is the bread, and then songs by anybody else in between.